Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Fasten your seatbelts, put your seats in the upright position, and switch off your cell phones. It's time for the Big Picture, the program in which we look at the political landscape and add some snap, crackle, and pop, and a good dash of masala. So, wherever you are, Jordan, the United States, Nigeria, or Russia, welcome. I am A.B. Dawji. So, with that dramatic introduction, let's see what we have for you today. Ah, yes. As usual, we begin with some weird, outlandish, incredibly silly stories in the news. But before that, a look at the local scene. Bangladeshi, Pakistani shops are being looted. Somali shops also are being looted. People are carrying away everything. What's the reason? Well, the claim is that these spaza shops are selling either expired foodstuff or fake foods. Fake foods means things like cool drinks, like maybe Coca-Cola made in someone's backyard. So people are very upset because they believe that expired and fake foods are dangerous to the health of the people in the townships, can make them sick. Okay, well, I understand that, but just wait a minute. People are raiding all these spaza shops and carrying away all this foodstuff. To do what? To consume it all at home. I am certain that they are not taking it to dump it somewhere because it's dangerous. No way, Jose. Can you, dear listeners, make sense of this? It's a very strange world we are living in. And here's a very strange story. It's not about anything that's fake. In fact, it's perfectly natural, completely 100% natural. But before I get to it, let me make a big declaration, something that I said before. There is never a shortage of mamparas in this world. In fact, there is an abundance of first-class laddus. And as the saying goes, there's a sucker born every day, meaning that ullus are ready to be taken for a ride. I remember coming across a story about a man in India who was selling a product that was guaranteed to kill mosquitoes. He sold his product via the internet, online. You paid him up front online, and then he posted this product to you, the guaranteed mosquito killer. Well, as I said, he advertised his product as a 100% guarantee that it will kill mosquitoes. And the best part was, it was so cheap, around 10 rands. And he sold thousands. You pay him, he sends you a small package. Inside are two small, flat, round pieces of stone. The instructions on a paper says, First catch the mosquito, then place it on one stone. Then use the other stone to smash the mosquito. Hey, what do you think of that? First catch the mosquito, then place it on one stone. Then use the other stone to smash the mosquito. Wasn't that brilliant? And you can't sue him, because if you do as the instructions say, the mosquito will be dead, guaranteed. And so this story reported in the British Independent newspaper. It says here, a businessman is raking in thousands of pounds selling jars of fresh air to people in China for £80 each. That's 1,700 rands in our money. Leo D. Watts, 27-year-old, sells air collected in the British countryside and ships it over to polluted cities in Shanghai and Beijing, where the wealthy elite pay a hefty sum for a few seconds of inhalation. It's called the Etia. The Etia products include air from Somerset, from Wales, and from Dorset, with each area set to create A with different qualities. Watt's website says this: ATAR is filtered organically by nature as it flows between the leaves of woodland trees, absorbs pristine water as it passes over babbling brooks and forest streams, and is lovingly caressed as it rolls over and between mineral-rich rock formations, after which it is blown up over vistas of untouched beauty to where the ATAR is collected and bottled. The bottles have already made Watts a huge amount of money, with the newspaper The Dorset Echo reporting that 180 have already been sold since the business started just a few weeks ago. As well as those buying the product to inhale, it is reportedly also being purchased by people who will never open it, but instead keep the jar for its novelty value. The air is collected using jars held in makeshift nets, which are held into the air and walked around in areas far removed from anywhere polluted, a process Watts described as air farming. Air farming. In addition to selling regular bottles of air, Watts, who lives in Hong Kong, is also doing what he calls a Chinese New Year special, which includes 15 jars of fresh air for £888, which is 13,300 rands. So, dear listeners, what did I tell you about mamparas, eh? Hullus. People in China are buying fresh air from Britain. Isn't that a great business? I think it's a great business idea. I think I'll look into it myself. All you people in polluted Johannesburg, listen here. Please get in touch with me. I will be bottling the pristine atmosphere from the rolling hills south of Durban in Umbumbulu, where nature is unspoiled and the air is unsullied by noxious emissions, and where the breezes blow through the leaves, which create a perfect filter to ensure that the purity of the product we bottle is guaranteed of the highest quality. Only 50 rands for a 2-liter bottle. Order 5 and get one free. Stocks are limited. Act fast and get your stocks now, right now. You will need it, because the fro is planning to boil the ojri from Bakri Eid. Well, there you are, folks. I like that part about stocks being limited, as if the air in Umbumbulu will suddenly get finished. But you never know. I might just get a few orders from Johannesburg. You heard of the expression, selling ice to the Eskimos? Well, you can add a new one to that, selling air to the Chinese. Right, now to some serious stuff, and today I will be focusing on Israel. Yes, you may ask the question, why Israel? There are other hot spots, burning issues, places that are being ravished, death and destruction. Okay, here's why. Because not much is changing in these places, although the situations are very serious indeed. But there is very little new development. For example, Syria, Assad is knocking the hell out of his people, and in coming days, more bombardment in Idlib. Since 2011, this has been going on. Extremely bad, of course, but as I said, no new developments. The carnage continues. Kashmir, no change. The Indian Army's brutal repression continues. Yemen, the news almost every night is about the bombardment by the Saudi Air Force, buildings flattened, children killed, and of course the terrible, terrible starvation. Horrible, but no new developments in terms of the scenario changing one way or the other. So, I'm sure that you understand what I'm saying. No, I'm not being blasé. Yes, maybe I am guilty of being fatalistic, meaning that reporting that 10 people were killed in Yemen yesterday or 5 today is not newsworthy. It's just what we call the new normal. The new normal. Terrible, but it's happening every day. But don't misunderstand me, okay? Don't misunderstand me. Khabardar! But when it comes to Israel, new things seem to be happening all the time. Big things, new developments. So that's why there is an inordinate amount of focus on Israel, disproportionate. Okay? The Palestinians have been attacked and are being attacked in many ways. Let's look first at those things that have been happening to them. Firstly, we know all about the house demolitions, the land confiscations, the attacks by the settlers, and the suffocating siege. We know about the Friday March of Return, the demonstrations at the Israel-Gaza border or the fence. Israel is murdering them in cold blood. 240 were injured yesterday, on Friday, including a female medic and a 10-year-old child. Both are in serious conditions. So far, Israel has murdered 166 Palestinians and wounded 18,000. Did you get that? 18,000! Try to imagine that, 18,000. The world doesn't care. It's not worth reporting. These are all terrorists, you see, all terrorists. So, about new developments, dramatic ones. But before I get there, here is a story from way back. George Bush was in the White House, and a very old man was outside and was shouting very loudly, "George Bush is an idiot! George Bush is an idiot! George Bush is an idiot!" Well, the police came very quickly and arrested him. He was put on trial. The judge sentenced him to 6 months for disturbing the peace and for calling George Bush an idiot. He got 10 years for revealing a state secret. Well, things have not changed very much. The White House lunatic asylum has still got another nutcase in there. My dear friend, Donald. Shame, he was complaining last week that when he puts his name into Google, only bad things about him come out. He's very cross with Google, saying that they are doing this deliberately to him. Hey, Baya, if you act like an Ullu with your silly tweets every week, what do you expect? Nice things to come up? And now, let's look at Israel. Let's look at the peace deal signed in 1993 between the Palestinians and Israel to stop fighting, known as the Oslo Accords, and how to move forward in peace. Well, Palestinians were to stop their violent struggle, come back to the West Bank and Gaza, and take control of 7 little towns in the West Bank, Nablus and Ramallah and so on, and parts of Gaza. The main issue, the big ones, the hot potato ones, were to be negotiated later on after the peace deal is signed, and it all was to be settled within 5 years from 1993. What were these hot issues? Well, the borders of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. Yes, that was the deal. The Palestinians were to get an independent state. That's number one. Number two, the status of Jerusalem will be under international control, or maybe the Palestinians will get half of it as their capital. This has to be negotiated. They'll get East Jerusalem as the capital, where Al-Aqsa is located at the moment. This is going to be negotiated, as I said. And finally, what will happen to the 5 million Palestinian refugees who are now in Gaza, West Bank, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, and Egypt? People who left their homes and ran when Israel was created in 1948. That, briefly, are the three hot potato issues that had to be negotiated. Let's see what happened since then. On the Palestinian state, well, in 1993, there were 100,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank, so you expect them to be removed in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Today, there are 500,000. So the land for the Palestinian state has been gobbled up, and every day new settlements are built. Second point, Jerusalem. Enter Donald Duck. He moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing Israel's right to the whole city. End of negotiations on Jerusalem. Now, we come to the question of the refugees. 750,000 were chased by Zionists when Israel was created in 1948. They ran for their lives to places I've just mentioned to you, Jordan and Lebanon. They are living in refugee camps. They have been there, and of course since then, since 1948, and they had children who grew up, married, had children again, and so on. And today, the total number is 5 million, recognized as refugees. They want to go back home. About 90% of the people, for example, in Gaza, originally had their homes in what is now Israel. So that's the scenario. These people are living in terrible conditions. Obviously, the countries like Lebanon cannot give them citizenship because Israel would like that. Of course, the Palestinians will then be Lebanese citizens and have jobs and will settle down completely and will not want to go back to their homes in Israel. So they still remain as Palestinians, whether in Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, etc. They are all battling, struggling. And so you have had for many decades a United Nations body known as UNRWA, UNWRA, United Nations Work and Refugee Agency, or Relief Agency, supporting them with food, providing schools and clinics and so on. And all countries of the world have donated money to UNRWA for this purpose, even the United States. But enter Donald Duck. He, earlier this year, said that the United States will slash its $300 million contribution to the United Nations. Of course, that created panic. And on Friday, the U.S. announced that it will stop completely all contributions to UNRWA. That, dear listeners, is a huge blow. Very, very big. The United States announced that the figure of 5 million refugees must be re-looked at again. It said that only those who fled in 1948 from Israel and those who are alive today can be considered as refugees. Their children who were born in surrounding countries cannot be regarded as refugees. And therefore, not 5 million are refugees, only 500,000, half a million, according to the United States. And of course, Israel is happy. That is what the White House announced. Wow, with the wave of a magic wand, bim, shakra, sim, abracadabra, as we used to say in the old days, voila, 4.5 million Palestinians are no more refugees. And therefore, this is the punchline, the big one, they have no so-called right of return to Israel, which is one of the things that were supposed to be negotiated in that peace deal. Problem solved for Israel. And another big one, cut off their funding, and two things will happen. They will be forced to make a living somehow in the countries where they are, or move to some other place, another country far away from Israel to survive. So the story is over. Well, not quite. Palestinians in Gaza, West Bank, who will not get UNRWA's help, will be so desperate, so broken, that they will accept any lousy deal that Israel puts on the table. Finish and klar. And Netanyahu must be walking around with a nice big smile on his face. So we are speaking about new developments. Now we all know that Muslims are demonized all the time in the media. Terrible things are being said about us. That idiot Geert Wilders, the Dutch politicians, raised his stupid head again to declare a cartoon competition this week. And the Dutch Prime Minister said he supports him. It's freedom of speech, you see. The West likes this, but in typical George Orwell's Animal Farm style, some speech is more free than others. And so another attack on Palestinians. But to be more accurate, attack on supporters of Palestinians. It's been going on for a very long time, and the man in the spotlight is Jeremy Corbyn. He's a long-time activist for human rights and justice. Very good man. He is the leader of the British opposition Labour Party. And he is quite open about his support for justice for the Palestinians. But for some time, he has been under attack by pro-Israeli supporters inside his party and outside, and from many sectors of the media. The charge is that the Labour Party is promoting anti-Semitism. Now, let's unpack that. Anti-Semitism means hating all Jews. Of course, that is completely wrong. And then you have many people who hate what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, and therefore they criticize Israel for this. But get this. Supporters of Israel have been working very hard to join these two things together. That if you are opposed to Israel, if you are critical of Israel, then you are an anti-Semite, that you hate all Jews. So there are many people who are afraid to be called anti-Semites, and so they don't criticize Israel. So do you see how this is a big stick to silence people? What was that about freedom of speech? Huh? And so it started with the claim that some in the Labour Party are anti-Semites. And that they, of course, it may be true, there may be a few people there. But now they are going all out for the leader, Jeremy Corbyn. the Labour Party is very strong in Britain, and at the next elections, the Conservative Party of Theresa May could be booted out, and the pro-Palestinian Jeremy Corbyn could become the Prime Minister of Britain. Incidentally, did you see that Theresa May trying to dance last week? I think it was in Soweto or somewhere. She looked like she was having a seizure or needed urgently to go to the toilet. Anyway, right now, Jeremy Corbyn is under huge pressure, a total onslaught from the media and powerful figures in his party. And it looks like he is giving in to adopt what is known as the definition of anti-Semitism, developed by a pro-Israeli group known as the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA. Now, there are 11 clauses in the declaration about what, in the definition of anti-Semitism. Well, apparently. And guess what? Of 9 of the 11 relate to criticism of Israel. And poor Jeremy looks like he is going to adopt this declaration about anti-Semitism as part of the Labour Party's policy charter. If that happens, then any member of his party who infringes any of these 9 points can be thrown out of the party. A person who has done a first-class job of explaining this is Professor Norman Finkelstein, and he is of Jewish origin, and his members of his family were caught up in the Holocaust, and he was forced out of the university in the United States where he was teaching for many, many, many years because of his criticism of Israel and the books he wrote, including one called The Holocaust Industry. But that's a long story for another time. I regard him as one of the most brilliant minds and an expert on the Palestine-Israeli issue. When he was on a lecture tour of South Africa a few years ago, I had the pleasure of having him for supper at my home. Professor Finkelstein, well, you can Google him and watch him on YouTube. He is very calm, very collected, like a robot almost, but dynamic. And he can just eat you up and spit you out if you are speaking nonsense. And this week I had an article, I read an article he wrote about Corbyn and the push to include the definition of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Excellent analysis. It was in my newsletter. Anyway, I came across an interview. Norman Finkelstein was interviewed by, guess who? Huh? Yes, another outspoken verbal weapon of mass destruction, George Galloway. You must know him. I'll play you that interview after this break, so please listen very carefully.
We're going to be talking to Professor Norman Finkelstein, an American citizen, a man of considerable note, a man known throughout the world as a fearless intellectual who has faced many trials and tribulations for the courage that he has shown. It's not exaggerating to say he's a kind of a Jeremy Corbyn figure in that regard. He has been smeared and slandered and subject to all kinds of harassment and loss of tenure and loss of work and so on, because he speaks up in his own tradition for justice and for truth. Now, Norman Finkelstein doesn't normally get involved in British politics, but he got involved in the Margaret Hodge affair in a very small vignette on YouTube that I saw, which actually moved me to tears. And I'm not a man easily moved to tears. I hope he's with me now. Professor Norman Finkelstein, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, you're aware, although it's not your number one interest in life, that the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, is having a very, very difficult time trying to hold the line which he has maintained all of his life, which is to defend, stand up for the Palestinian people under occupation and siege. A lot of people don't like that. How have you seen recent developments, including the frankly absurd claim by Margaret Hodge, Dame Margaret Hodge, in the last couple of days, that she more or less saying that she feels like her father must have felt in the grip of the Holocaust in Nazi Germany. What do you say to people like that?
Well, first of all, it's not correct to say that this is not a priority issue for me. It is. Jeremy Corbyn represents the prospect of a real political breakthrough in the Western world, one which will have repercussions, reverberations everywhere. And what is now happening to Jeremy Corbyn is really just a premonition, a harbinger of what's going to happen if Bernie Sanders is nominated in 2020 in the Democratic Party. It's perfectly obvious to anybody who observes that the same sorts of tactics where Bernie is going to be smeared for positions he took in the 1970s and 80s, for example, his support of the Sandinistas, and then there's going to be all sorts of Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and then there'll be all sorts of guilt by association because many supporters of Palestinian rights have rallied around Bernie Sanders. And it was already clear when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won what became a nationwide significant victory in New York City, the first thing they tried to hang her on was statements she made about Gaza. So everything that's now happening to Corbyn is really a trial run, a prefiguration for what will happen in the U.S. if Bernie Sanders gets the nomination in 2020. So both for global reasons, the fact that his campaign can mark a significant breakthrough, a historic breakthrough, for the international left, and also for domestic reasons, I'm watching very closely the crucifixion of Corbyn and how to combat it, how to maneuver, and how to survive, not just survive, but survive with your principles intact. And that is a real challenge, especially as the people, many of the people surrounding Corbyn, such as the spokespeople from Momentum and some of the unions, are abandoning, they're jettisoning their principles, and trying to reach all sorts of unprincipled and potentially destructive compromises with the forces that are now arrayed against Corbyn. And so it's a matter of great interest to me, and I just hope that Corbyn himself displays wisdom and principle, especially as the people around him seem one by one like dominoes falling. There was a breakthrough yesterday when the barking Yenta, Dame Hodge, once again stuck her foot in her mouth, but this time people had enough already from this barking Yenta, or the Yenta from barking, and are now fighting back. And they're fighting back with what, in my opinion, is the most powerful of all political weapons. Namely, rather than trying to factually refute this barrage, this torrent of despicable lies, they're trying a new tack now, which is just to ridicule your enemy into submission. And so, trending now in the UK on Twitter is not George Galloway, and it's not even Tom Cruise for his new movie Mission Impossible, but what's trending now is the comparisons of Hodge. And that, to me, is the perfect weapon in order to defeat these moral blackmailers and moral extortionists who are engaging in a vile, despicable campaign of conscripting the suffering of Jews during World War II, the very real martyrdom of the Jewish people during World War II, conscripting them in this extortionist blackmail campaign to try to rid Jeremy Corbyn and the principled politics he represents, to oust him and more especially the politics he represents from public life. That's their agenda. It has nothing whatsoever to do with a problem of anti-Semitism, which is next to near absent in British life, except among troglodytes, antediluvians, and fruitcakes. It's next to near absent in British life. It's not about anti-Semitism. It's about, in the first place, justice for Palestinians, but more broadly, it's about a principled class politics that the ruling elites in the UK, whether they be the Blairites in the Labour Party, whether they be the media elite, or whether they be the Tories, they have coalesced, there has been a convergence, and now there is this anti-Corbyn juggernaut by those who want to preserve and protect the existing order. And then there is, on the other side, arrayed what you might call the 99% who think that the current order needs a shaking up. It needs to be re-established anew, and new, fairer, and more just foundations. And that's what Corbyn represents. A new order that's waiting to be born, and his enemies are the ones who want to abort that new order, that fetus. They want to abort it, and they're using the very real suffering that Jews endured in history generally, but during the Nazi Holocaust in particular. They're exploiting it in a sordid, really sordid, filthy campaign of blackmail and extortion to try to get Corbyn on his knees, or preferably out of the party and public life altogether?
Well, these are golden words that I predict will live for a long time and travel far. Let me pick up the dichotomy you identify first of all, that some of Corbyn's enemies are his enemies because they want to defend the existing state of affairs in Israel-Palestine, and others seek to destroy him because they fear the new order that he would be the harbinger of. And these two forces have now conflated and are together seeking to destroy the Labour Party under his leadership. Let's deal with the first part of the dichotomy first. The intervention of Netanyahu himself via Twitter seems that the Trump effect is catching on, and important statements are made by countries' leaders on Twitter. And Netanyahu's attack on Corbyn on Twitter this week, how significant was that for you?
Well, let's begin with the basics. Benjamin Netanyahu is an obnoxious, racist, Jewish supremacist who never for a moment hesitates to insert himself and Israeli interests in general in the domestic politics of other countries. So what you had a small taste of this past week, we had a much larger taste of when this obnoxious, racist, Jewish supremacist barged into the U.S. Capitol in defiance of and in defiance and in a, let's just now call it defiance, of a sitting U.S. president, and thought he had the right, and in fact he thought he had the authority to lecture our elected U.S. Congress on the threat posed allegedly by Iran, and he had the arrogance, the presumption to acquit himself as if he knew more than our State Department, our Defense Department, our CIA. He, the obnoxious, racist, Jewish supremacist, carried on as if he were more knowledgeable than the whole of our governmental system on the threat posed by Iran. And he didn't think in the least awry, amiss for him to be intervening in domestic American politics. Now, what happened to Corbyn? Jewish organizations, mostly unelected, decided that from afar and from above, they were going to issue ultimatums, take it or leave it, to the Labour Party, and from afar and from above, these unelected Jewish bodies, or mostly unelected Jewish bodies, are going to dictate internal Labour third-party policy in defiance of the opinions of the elected party leadership. They are doing now exactly as Netanyahu did at the time of the Iran deal in the United States. The arrogance, the presumption are really breathtaking when you add another factor, namely, overwhelmingly, British Jews do not even support the Labour Party. It's about 15% of British Jewry votes Labour. Even when there is a Jewish candidate heading the list, as was the case with Ed Miliband in 2015, still only about 15%, if my memory is correct, about 15% of British Jews supported the Labour Party. And then you have to ask yourself a simple, and I would want to underscore, democratic question. By what right does this alien body, alien to the Labour Party, foreign to the Labour Party, by what right do these mostly unelected Jewish hoodlums, by what right do they have to dictate the internal policy of a democratically controlled party and democratically elected leadership? These are pure mafia tactics. It's the equivalent of taking out a wrench and breaking kneecaps. These are thugs. And you don't negotiate, you don't compromise with thugs. You draw a line and you say, you crossed a red line. We debated, we deliberated, we offered to consult. As Len McCluskey wrote yesterday in British HuffPost, he listed nearly a dozen, and maybe it was a dozen, compromises that Corbyn had offered. The multiple olive branches he extended to the Jewish leadership, so-called leadership. They were leadership, by the way, exactly like the Judenrats in Nazi Germany during World War II. That's the kind of leadership they are. Exactly mirror images of the Judenräte, the Jewish councils that were set up by the Nazis in World War II. That's the leadership. But he extends one olive branch, he meaning Corbyn, one olive branch, another olive branch, another olive branch, and another, and another, and another, and another olive branch. And what does he get in return? The barking Yenta height? For those words alone, she should have been ejected from the Labour Party, not because she violated or breached any ethical code, but because...
Well, look, Professor, one last question we've only got time for. will this end well if Jeremy Corbyn capitulates in the next week or so and agrees to all their demands? Would that be the end of it, do you think?
No, it's the beginning. They've made that clear. As the representative from the CAA said, our goal is to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. This is only, unfortunately and alas, this is only act one, scene one of what's going to
be a protracted
soap opera or tragic comedy unless Corbyn removes himself.
I'll tell you what, when we get to, Professor, when we get to Act 2, as like you, I'm perfectly sure we will, it'll be good to talk to you again. Professor Norman Finkelstein is the son of parents who were incarcerated in Auschwitz. Almost all of his family were massacred by actual Nazism in the Holocaust, which raged across Nazi-occupied Europe in the late 1930s and throughout the Second World War. He is a professor of significance, a figure of world authority. He says this is the crucifixion of Jeremy Corbyn.